are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, June 7th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday, folks. You know what that means? Well, maybe you don't. David Dayan, the new executive editor of the American Prospect, will be here. Also on the program today, Andy Kindler, executive editor of the Andy Kindler Twitter feed, will be here.
Wait, I call him the unofficial ombudsman of CNN.
The ombudsman?
Ombudsman. That's the way you say it, right?
Ombudsman.
I want to get too. I want to get too persnickety about pronunciation, Sam.
No, I won't. Also on the program today, House backs off contempt, but intend to get those answers from Barr and Ross through the courts. Meanwhile, Dr. Hyde to Mr. Jekyll. Biden flips on the Hyde Amendment. Also, Mexico and Trump may come to a deal to further immiserate the miserable. Meanwhile, Trump allows the Saudis to have U.S. high-tech bomb-making secrets, and wages and jobs crawl to an unexpected halt. Meanwhile, the TurboTax giveaway killed by a ProPublica piece. Sudanese uprising being crushed by a military government. Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham lose a big advertiser. Cue censorship cries. Tlaib introduces UBI in the House. And Susan Collins is all in on anti-abortion Trump judges. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to it. Thank you for tuning in. It is another Friday. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. It's its members that keep us going, inoculate us from any type of YouTube demonetization, sort of like on the Steven Crowder model. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Very easy URL, which apparently Michael cannot remember. I listened to the program yesterday, Michael. And
what did I say?
Well, you did like slash become a member dash whatever it was. Why not just join the majority?
https://SK. Oh, wait, sorry. That's Skillshare. My bad.
Yeah. All right.
It's confusing.
Well, that's why I say jointhemajorityreport.com.
Give me points on them. I'll remember it that way.
Oh, boy. All right, folks. Yes, you can support the program that way. And let's get right into it. Joe Biden, and I think this is going to be a problem for Joe Biden.
Definitely.
Because aside from the fact that it's going to be hard for people to believe that he's actually changed his mind, again, the one thing that has been clear about Joe Biden's support is that he is supposedly the one guy who can definitely beat Donald Trump. There should be no weakness there. And to flip on a position that you had. Now, look, I guess I'm glad that Joe Biden has flipped. If I was to believe it, it's not like he's in Congress now or he's going to be in a lawmaking position anyways. But look, we know that Joe Biden was willing to trade Social Security for a set of taxes that were going to expire anyways. We know this about Joe Biden. He basically interceded with Harry Reid's negotiations by basically undercutting him in the fiscal cliff negotiations back in, I guess it was in 2011, maybe in 2010. To be honest with you, I can't remember now. I'm too old. But just listen to this AP headline. After 2 days of intense criticism, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden reversed course Thursday and declared he no longer supports a longstanding congressional ban on using federal health care money to pay for abortions. The Hyde Amendment is almost 30 years old. Joe Biden has held this position for 30 years. And it took 2 days of criticism for him to reverse himself. Play this clip.
Is that when in fact there is this enormous pressure and even threat to close down clinics that are available in the past for women who do not have the funds but are able to have them paid for privately, as we've been able to do, that was one thing. But we now see so many Republican governors denying health care to millions of the most poorest and most vulnerable Americans by refusing even Medicaid expansion. I can't justify leaving millions of women without access to the care they need and the ability to exercise their constitutionally protected right. If I believe health care is a right as I do, I can no longer support an amendment that makes that right dependent on someone else.
I mean, he attempts to make this about what's going on in the states across the country. It's absurd. The problem has existed. The ability for women living in poverty and having trouble to get abortions because Medicaid would not finance it has been a longstanding problem. And he just didn't care.
Well, as I pointed out yesterday in reporting yesterday, Biden voted against Medicaid covering abortion in the 70s, quite a while ago. But I mean, he did in his own voting record precisely what he's using to get himself out of that position today.
Yeah, it's pretty stunning. Joe Biden does that now. Here's the other thing: I think from a meta perspective, it really is problematic for him because he's a guy who's been trying to project this sense of, I don't know if I would call it inevitability, but certainly a sense of like strength. And this shows weakness. I think it's going to undercut him. When we have David Dayan on in a bit, we will talk more about what's going on with 2020, because he was out in California at this big California Democratic convention. I should tell you, folks, we've also just as a little bit of house cleaning, you can go to Instagram. Our Instagram feed, we've been playing around with it. We have finally figured out how to do this. We now have an AI bot that is now doing our Instagram, and it is exceptional. We tried it out with a human being. We found that to be too cumbersome. And this AI bot really anticipates what we want on Instagram. So everybody should head over there now. Instagram.com/majorityreport.fm. That is a weird handle. We got to try and change that. But here it is. There's our Instagram. We have some AI device that Kyle rigged up that actually generates these memes and then posts them. So
should we
I don't,
be concerned that the rest of us are going to be replaced by bots?
I mean, I was talking about this with Andy Kindler when I invited him on today. I'm hoping that's happening. My dream is to someday on a Friday sit back with Andy Kindler with a cup of coffee and just listen to the both of us doing the show without us actually having to be there. That is where I'm headed. So we'll see. Oh, folks.
That's awesome. My AI will be there. Take
as,
care.
As long as we still get paid, I'm cool with that plan.
Two Jewish AI.
Two Jewish AI bots with a lot of emotional baggage is the next step in the process.
There the we go. All that feeling the... bot. I only do pedantic arguments and I get aggrieved. I'm the CETA bot.
Folks, time spent in traffic is not time spent exploring, creating, and having fun. Now you can use Boosted to get where you need to be faster. It's designed to provide a luxurious experience. Boosted vehicle-grade electric skateboards and scooters are the modern solution to your transportation woes. I am so all in on this.
They look really fun.
And the thing that I appreciate about it, they're showing people, wear your helmets. There was some report I just saw. I can't remember what city it was. Like 1/6 of all the people in the city are driving electric scooters now. Boosted has a 22-mile range, maximum speeds of 24 miles per hour. It's perfect for both running to the store and traveling across town. With 5 options to pick from, including their new scooter, the Boosted Rev, there's a personal electric vehicle that's tailor-made for you. They're just starting at $61 a month with financing. No wonder Boosted was one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018 and also got Brendan's. It got your.
But he's been a Boosted ambassador for a long time, since like 2013 or so. He's been on the train early. He was like, you got to get in on this. It's good stuff.
But when did your official endorsement, because your buddy is an ambassador?
Oh, probably right around then. He's a very persistent salesman.
We're talking about almost a six-time Brendan. Look, folks, there's no time better than now to change the way you move. Right now, Boosted is offering our listeners $75 off the purchase of an electric vehicle when you use the code MAJORITY at checkout. You go to boostedboards.com, Boosted, BOOSTEDBOARDS, boostedboards.com. Use the code MAJORITY at checkout. Get $75 off your vehicle. That's Boosted Boards, promo code MAJORITY at checkout. For $75 off, I'm so close to pulling the trigger on that. I definitely want one of those.
You should do it, man.
I think I'm going to.
They look really fun.
You, Mylan, Saul, Cruisin'?
That's fun. It's just like
efficient.
It's. I mean, it's just a question of efficiency, and that's what I need. I need an extra like half an hour, 45 minutes a day right now. And if I could get that, like just even going to softball, rather than having to go dig out my bike, which is a pain, I can just take this out of my apartment.
Well, if the MTA keeps going the way it has been, this may be the more efficient option soon.
That's why I can't wait for Elon Musk to invent a tunnel where people just ride their electric scooters through it.
Like some type of like half underground bike lane that's super uncomfortable and inefficient that covers like a half a block.
If they ended up shutting the L,
you have to buy the proprietary Elon Musk bike as well, of course.
If they shut the L down, that's what they could have used. We don't have time for this Joe Rogan video. Maybe we'll play it. Maybe we'll play it right after David Dayan. But David Pakman was on Joe Rogan the other day. And Joe Rogan brought us both up, Michael Robinson.
Yes, indeed.
What is your last name again?
Hey, well, Joe apologized, so no, I don't need to make a thing of it. He called me Michael Roberts, and a lot of people pointed out, apparently, that was not the end. Joel, like a gentleman, tweeted a sincere apology and followed me on Twitter. So basically, I just go back to my original point, which is that Joe is a breath of fresh air in the discourse.
We got. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Also, just a reminder, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan. Your dad told you not to look at me. Down came the face upon your head. I was the only other adult around. I was the only other adult around. I was 18, you were 8, maybe you were 10. He said she's not gonna help you. He said she's not. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the now executive editor of the American Prospect. And I can't encourage everyone and anyone more to go over there and get a subscription to the American Prospect. I am so excited to see what's going to happen going forward. With this, and the Prospect I've read, you know, for years, and David Dayan, welcome to the program. I was just, you know, talking about you that,
I'm going to let you do that.
Well,
I'm
going
to let you keep doing that.
I've been reading the Prospect for years, and it was, you know, sometimes great, sometimes not so interesting to me. A bunch of interesting pieces over the years, obviously, and we've had guests on from there. But I am so excited to have you this be your new job. Not only have you're way overdue for a job like this, but frankly, I'm very excited to see where this goes. I mean, I interviewed Bill Lozonik on a piece that he wrote the other day about we've been talking to Bill Lozonik for years on this program about what's happened with CEOs and their executive pay and the way that they get paid and the shareholder buybacks. And he tied it into the 737 stuff. And it's fascinating and only in the American Prospect.
Yeah, that was a good piece. We're excited about the way forward. Prospect obviously has been around for 30 years, has a really rich legacy. You could probably name any major media site in journalism, and someone, if not multiple people from the Prospect and their past have worked there, whether you're talking about Ezra Klein or Matt Iglesias or Jamel Bowie or Adam Serwer or Nick Confessore or whoever. We're looking to continue that legacy and move it forward. We're looking at hiring new writers. We're looking at there's going to be a redesign of the website. There's going to be, you know, I think an increased focus on the kinds of things that I write about regularly, which are really power dynamics, whether you're talking about politics or you're talking about business, talking about the economy. I'm really excited to build something that I think will make a contribution.
Great. Well, let's talk about a couple of pieces that you actually wrote about in the Prospect this past week. Both of which, you know, we talked about on the program early this week to a certain extent, not as in depth as you covered here. And I want to also touch on Biden's reversal and what you make of that as well. But you were out at the California Democratic Convention. And basically wrote about how almost everyone there on some level or another was distinguishing themselves from Joe Biden, who seems to feel like the strategy to win the nomination and maybe the presidency is to run like it's 1995.
I'd say more like 1900. You know, William McKinley did his famous front porch campaign, where he never left his front porch, and well-wishers came to him. That was the sum total of his campaigning. And, you know, obviously in 1900, it might have been a little harder to traverse the country. But Biden apparently doesn't know of the existence of planes or large halls where you could speak one-on-one to candidates. There is very little campaigning going on in the first couple months, and it seems like Biden wants to get out of his own way and not screw it up. And really, if you look at this week, that's probably a good bet, right? I mean,
yeah,
he comes out for the Hyde Amendment and then has to backtrack. And so, you know, staying out of the public eye is probably a good idea for Joe Biden, given his history with presidential campaigns.
Well, isn't this going to be a problem for him? I mean, this is what I've been, and I want to get your sense of this, and because maybe I'm completely off base, but this is going to catch up with him. Like, I mean, to a certain extent, there was a little bit of this that Clinton tried to do early on in her campaign. I think the DNC scheduling all the debates in 2016 on the weekends was also a function of this on some level, right? Yeah, I mean, that they wanted to sort of basically, you know, run like an incumbent's race on some level. But Joe Biden is not.
I mean, and by the way, that's it's not like it's breaking new ground or anything.
Right.
This is what most front runners do. They try to limit their exposure, because if you're winning, the only thing that can happen is to the downside. So, you know, why wouldn't you to a certain extent? But I don't think it's sustainable. I mean, you know, Biden's not going to skip these debates, right? And that's going to be sort of the most high profile thing. We're going to see those in just a matter of weeks here. And that, you know, there are going to be plenty of moments that can change this dynamic. And it's certainly not sustainable for him to just sort of, you know, stay out of the public eye for the rest of this campaign on to, you know, 2020.
Did the California convention, it seems to me, marked the, in some ways, the beginning of the, the race, I don't want to say the race as much as, but the, like the idea that like, okay, we're running against Joe Biden here.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, except for a couple like, you know, Hickenlooper and Delaney trying to run against socialism or whatever.
Right.
But for the most part, this was the kickoff, I feel like, of the campaign. Now, there's another one this week. There's a cattle call in Iowa. But there were 14 candidates over in San Francisco. And the ones with a real shot to win did set up this argument. Particularly around not just Biden, but I've been calling it Bidenism. You know, this, and it's not limited to him, but this sort of establishment idea that what we need is a restoration presidency. We need a return to normalcy, as Warren Harding ran on in 1920. We just need to get Trump out of there, and everything will be all right, and we all can go back to brunch. And what the argument that and not limited to just sort of the candidates on the progressive side, but versions of this were said by Booker and Buttigieg, in addition to Warren and Sanders, that's not going to be enough. That the history of the recent history within our country of an economy that doesn't lift everyone up, that's you know, a climate crisis, and all of these various things that are pushing up inequality and giving the middle class less opportunities to make it, those things existed before Donald Trump, and they're going to exist after him, and we need to structurally make some changes in order to remedy that, because it's the clear challenge facing the country. And a go slow, you know, try to make compromise, you know, don't fight too hard kind of approach is not what we need at this time. I mean, Warren had that great line when she said, if someone, a politician, is telling you that you, you know, don't make waves, you can't do everything at once, you go slow, what they're really telling you is they're not going to fight for you,
right?
When you're when the chips are down, and that's really the argument. That's the argument that was set up, and that's the argument I think you're going to see on display in a few weeks in these presidential debates.
Do you think we're going to see more? I mean, I've been sort of surprised, and I haven't seen any reactions to Biden's flip here. And you know, I think, look, I don't think it's any secret that Biden is my least favored candidate in this race. Although I, you know, maybe John Delaney, and there's a couple others there. But
I mean, does he rise to the level of being a favorite or not, like John Delaney or John Hickenlooper? I mean,
right.
It was so funny to see, you know, nobody was paying attention to those speeches when they were being made until the word socialism came up. It was almost like a wake word, like an Alexa. Socialism was said, and then people, you know, turned their heads up. The only thing worse than getting booed is not being paid attention to at all. And that's what was happening prior to that. And I suspect that's what will continue to happen, after, you know, Delaney and Hickenlooper's 15 minutes of being booed.
Do you think that's why they did it? Do you think that's,
yeah,
why?
I mean, I think it's absolutely why, Hickenlooper did it. He ran ads about it afterwards. He went on a little tour of the media afterwards. Delaney might just be clueless. I don't really know. But Hickenlooper, it was a considered strategy, and one that we've seen in California. In 1990, Dianne Feinstein was running for governor, actually, and she was in a primary, and she came out in favor of the death penalty very strongly at a California Democratic Party convention, was lustily booed, and then she used that footage in an ad during the campaign. She actually ended up losing. She did not become California governor, and later on she became senator. But this is a strategy. I mean, you know, you can call it sister soldier or whatever. Of course, Clinton did that after the nomination was locked up, not when he was trying to get Democratic votes. So I don't think it's a successful strategy.
All right. So getting back, here's my question about Biden. Are we going to see some of these candidates, or is it too early for this to start to hit Biden? Like on this, there seems to me to be two things, right, that Biden is vulnerable to. One is the idea that he inevitably can win, and the other is that he needs to be on some level cleaved from his association with Barack Obama. And that's difficult for some of the candidates who were critical about some of Obama's thing and Obama's policies. And I imagine that they don't want to, the way that they would cleave these guys is tricky. But Joe Biden came out, you know, weeks ago and said, I'm going to be able to, after Donald Trump is gone, I'm going to be able to deal with the Republicans. And
right.
isn't sort of like the implication there that Barack Obama couldn't do it, but I can? I mean, if I wanted to cleave Joe Biden from Barack Obama, I would say, I would pose the question, why does Joe Biden think that he is able to do what Barack Obama couldn't do? And
I mean, that's one way to do it. I think the other way to do it is just to say, open your eyes, Joe. I mean, look at what the blockade that we've seen. And going back even before Obama, right? Going to the Clinton administration or, you know, since the Reagan Revolution, what in that history is something that you think you can find common ground on? I mean, this is insane. And, that's, you know, ultimately going to be a dynamic that is not going to get the American public to a place where they need to be. I think that's probably a better way of putting it to a Democratic audience. I mean, I think we get a little caught up too much in Obama's role in all of this. Clearly Biden is running on that affinity. I mean, he's running on that affiliation with Obama. I mean, it's notable that Obama aides aren't really running with him. There are plenty of not just fundraising support, but actual former aides who are looking at other candidates. But what I would say is that you can just sort of look at the reality of where the Republican Party has gone over the last 40 years and just look incredulously at anyone thinking that there's some place of common ground that you can find.
What do we know about how they're going to be picking the who's on which stage during these debates? Because that seems to me to be also pretty
important. The lottery, as far as I know, it's a luck of the draw situation, and that's pretty important. I mean, at least for this first one. Now, you know, later debates are going to have less members in it. The DNC has come out and said that they're raising the bar for whether you can participate in these debates in the future. And so eventually there will be a debate with the top candidates taking the stage, Biden and Warren and Harris and Sanders and Buttigieg. This one is all luck of the draw. So, you know, Biden could get in there with a bunch of people polling at 2% or less. I mean, it's entirely possible.
Wow.
Maybe the DNC will put their thumb on the scale in some way. I don't know if this is a public process of drawing lots or anything, but it's certainly unpredictable. And if you don't have Biden and Warren in the same debates, then there's going to be a different dynamic if you don't have Biden and Sanders in the same debate.
I think we should be starting a call right now to have that be a public process. You know, something like, the way they do the lottery numbers on, Channel 5 or whatever it is. They pull it out of a...
Well, it's like the NBA draft lottery.
Yeah.
Right? That's done in a back room, and then the Knicks end up with Patrick Ewing.
Why wouldn't you do that if you were the DNC? That would be a brilliant, I think, social media strategy, unless, of course, you really wanted to make sure that Joe Biden didn't end up on the stage with anybody who's going to challenge him in a sort of a material.
I mean, from a pure ratings standpoint, you'd think that they would want to do the opposite, that they would want to get all their big names in the same debate. But they've been pretty adamant that they didn't want to do a kiddie table kind of debate like the Republicans did in 2016.
I think that's fair enough. I think that's fair enough, at least at the beginning, as you say. But I mean, mix it up a little bit. But let's talk a little bit also about this question of Jay Inslee. He wrote a piece about Jay Inslee, and he has basically branded his campaign as one that is focused like a laser beam on climate change. He has certainly, pushed the limit, as it were, and I don't know the limit, but within the limits of, I guess, American politics, in terms of Washington State with climate. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll go into the sort of the dynamics in the campaign regarding that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've seen this before a little bit of people running sort of single issue presidential campaigns designed to elevate a particular issue that they find existential. And we haven't seen it on climate in a Democratic primary before. Inslee is really the first one to try this. And there have been some sort of fortuitous circumstances around that, most notably this attention paid to the Green New Deal and the work of the Sunrise Movement and people like that. That has given sort of a path for Inslee to make this stand. And you know, usually these single issue kind of candidates aren't necessarily running to be president, although I think Inslee has certain qualifications in that regard. They're running to make sure that issue is a priority, that it's front and center within the context of the party that they're trying to influence. And I think Inslee is doing a pretty good job of that. He's setting sort of a gold standard in terms of his policies. He has successfully, I believe, connected climate to all of these other challenges that we face, whether it's the declining share of the labor movement, because there's a labor component to his climate change policy, the state of the economy, of green manufacturing, of you know, economic growth, and returning the country to a dominant position in certain industries. He's connected it to immigration with this concept of climate migrants and how you know, our foreign policy might be better served by helping these countries be sustainable and successful on their own right, rather than getting millions of their people at our border, like we're seeing particularly in Guatemala, where harvests are dying rapidly and climate migrants are coming to the United States because they have simply no other option. So you see it in an immigration context and also in a sort of international relations context. He's talked about trade deals needing environmental components at the forefront. He's talked about international cooperation on the climate crisis. So, you know, the ability to sort of connect to that, this fundamental challenge to these other issues, I think is very important, because it really centers climate at the core. And, you know, I think he's been pretty successful in getting other candidates within this primary race to move in his direction, much like we're seeing in a dynamic with Elizabeth Warren sort of more generally, where she's put out these plans and now everybody is scrambling to put out their own plans. In a climate context, that is the dynamic that Inslee is facilitating, and I think that's a really good role. Above and beyond the fact that he does have a pretty decent record on a number of issues.
So what he wanted to, this debate, the DNC said no. It seems to me like there's a potential here, and I don't know. I have not been paying attention to that sort of discourse around there, but it seems to me like we're two candidates who are in the middle of the pack could just basically say, we're going to do this. And the DNC would then be in a position of basically bumping those people from future debates because they want to go on and talk about climate change. That seems like a fairly...
Yeah, I think this is an organizing opportunity. And I think Inslee and his campaign sees it that way. And they're not going to stop. The two candidates that sort of jumped aboard in reiterating that there should be a climate debate were Elizabeth Warren and Beto O'Rourke. So two of the candidates in the upper tiers, I would put Warren in the top tier and Beto just below that at this point. But, you know, if there's a coalition that can be built, a larger one of 10 candidates, 12 candidates that say, we're just going to go ahead and do this, that puts a lot of pressure on the DNC. That would make it very difficult for the DNC to sort of continue this stance that, because their position is that if you do an outside debate, we're going to disqualify you from any DNC debates. We're not going to invite you anymore. And I should say that that's a new rule. That isn't some sort of iron law that the DNC gets to manage what candidates can say in large formats, televised formats, in debates. We saw plenty of debates in 2008 that were not sanctioned by the DNC. I remember going to one at Yearly Coast, which is now
right.
Netroots Nation 2007, This was something that Debbie Wasserman Schultz implemented in 2016.
Right.
This idea that you can't do outside debates, and it's a bit silly. I mean, it's really a micromanagement kind of situation where you're trying to manage the access and of these candidates in ways that I don't really understand. I think it's ripe for challenge. I think if you get enough, you know, a tipping point of candidates to participate in a debate of that kind, particularly if you get the front runner, Joe Biden, who put out a climate policy this week that got some generally good, a little bit mixed reviews, and was certainly closer to an Inslee type of, although it wasn't at that level, it was closer to it than the sort of middle ground that he was looking for in published reports with members of his staff. If you can get a good number of people, I think you can sort of call the bluff of the DNC on this.
I feel like if Warren, Beto, Sanders, Inslee, and Harris all said that we're going to do this, I mean, what are they going to do? Not let those people on the debate stage? I mean, that's
it seems crazy that that would be the outcome, and that would sort of be the end of that. So, as I said, I think it's an organizing opportunity for Inslee, and then an opportunity for him to continue into this area.
Let's talk a little bit. I want to just change topics a little bit, because the other big thing this week that, you know, and part of that is our own myopia here on some level. But there was on Twitter, as an extension of YouTube, a controversy that was a function of Carlos Maza. Is that it? Is his name? I keep Maza. Is a Vox YouTuber, and he does these explainers. I've seen one or two.
Think about what you would have said if someone said to you 10 years ago, 15 years ago, he's a Vox YouTuber.
Right.
And that's a job that you can have.
Well, that's the weird thing about this. I mean, because, you know, like on some level, I'm quite convinced that this is in some fashion or another the future. I don't know if it's going to be YouTube, and I don't know if it's going to be Vox, but it's going to be two other words that we can't even imagine what they mean from 10 years from now. But it's going to be some measure of this or not. I mean, because, you know, part of it is that in 2004, there was no YouTube. Kicked in, I think, you know, later that year or something. And now it is a dominant platform. The Steven Crowder would address these explainers and always make a point about the fact that Maza was gay and Mexican and, you know, basically just gay bash. Crowder has a lot of other things that I find ridiculous and stupid about him. But this is the one that sort of certainly runs contrary to YouTube's terms of service. And so Maza complained to YouTube, and they basically said to Steven Crowder, we're no longer monetizing your channel until you get rid of all the gay bashing, which to me seems fairly appropriate. I think there's other problems with YouTube from an antitrust perspective and from the role.
Yeah, I mean, let me just jump in. I think Steven Crowder is now seeing the problems with a narrowed distribution channel where there's only one way to get your communication out. The problem here seems to be that if there was an environment where you had all sorts of opportunities to distribute video content, then there would be the market would sort of figure out what where people go and this demonetization sort of threat hanging over the heads of every single YouTuber would be neutralized. But in this case, that's not the landscape that we have. And YouTube has this tremendous amount of power at their own whim to decide whether or not to cut off the livelihood of individuals. Now, I don't agree with Steven Crowder. I don't even know Steven Crowder until you told me we were going to be talking about this an hour or so ago.
You live a charmed life.
What I do know is that, should an organization like YouTube have the power to turn on or off the potential livelihood of individuals based on the amount of lobbying they get from the outside, or based on their own particular political or public relations whim? No. And that's the major problem here. I'm not clued in necessarily to this debate, but what I would say is that This is a problem of a concentrated distribution network.
Right. And the it seems to me, I mean, obviously YouTube is not in a position to diversify, and to break themselves up. So you've been looking into this for a long time. What how would that work? Right. Like what would be, and I know there's plans out there, but I think people have a hard time sort of conceiving of this, because look, there are, you could put your videos on Vimeo. There are other platforms for video content. There's other ways to monetize YouTube stuff. We had an ad apocalypse, about a year and a half ago. And a lot of YouTubers basically said, support the show on Patreon. In some fashion, mm-hmm. and it mm-hmm. was perfectly effective for them. But the idea.
So here's what I would say.
Go ahead.
This is obviously part of a larger thing, because when we're talking about YouTube, we're talking about Google. Like Google bought YouTube way back in 2006 or 7 or something, and Google. Eric Schmidt, the former executive chairman of Google, has said in the past that Google would make an acquisition per week of other applications, other potential rivals, things like that. So the easiest way to sort of go about this is just reverse a lot of that. And with Google, maybe you're talking about YouTube, but you're probably definitely talking about DoubleClick, which is the ad serving software that they this is what has enabled Google to not just be an ad destination, but an advertising supplier and facilitator. So it's bring forth an ad exchange, an actual market to put advertisers and users together, while also competing with them. So this is sort of the bigger problem. When you're talking about Amazon, maybe you're talking about splitting Zappos, which was an emerging site until Amazon bought them, or splitting it from Amazon Web Services, which is sort of the firmament, this cloud network that undergirds a giant portion of the internet. When you're talking about Facebook, it's the direct competitors to them they've bought, Instagram and WhatsApp. So just reversing those mergers, number one, would decentralize the power to a certain extent.
So what? So
as far as
for YouTube, mm-hmm, just give me an example. So all right, so we separate YouTube from Google. We separate YouTube from AdSense. And then what happens? It becomes just less.
Well, I mean, the fundamental point here is that Google's ownership of YouTube has been a driving force in moving users looking for videos into right. YouTube, right? And if you sever that relationship, then maybe if you're searching, you're not necessarily only getting Google you're not necessarily only getting YouTube responses to your queries on Google. So that's one way in which this can manifest. The other way is that it is the role of the competition authorities to make sure that we can provide some of that. And maybe there's a role for a public facing network, or fostering some sort of competition within there. And then the third thing would be a regulatory impact. So, I mean, the problem with Google, and it's come up this week, is that their algorithm, which requires or prefers, I should say, a certain amount of engagement, has inevitably sends people down these rabbit holes of conspiracy and makes it easy for pedophiles to find certain bits of content. And that algorithmic problem is one that, in my view, could be regulated so that Google can be, or YouTube can be a network that isn't promoting hatred or promoting or at least moving people into that direction. My general thought is that the more competition there is, you fight speech with more speech, and everybody can sort of, find their level.
And we could also, from a regulatory standpoint, assuming that the industry that we're regulating wasn't so massive and powerful as to essentially own the regulatory agencies, we could also say something to the effect of like, hey, if you're going to be in that algorithms can only be relied upon so much in the context of this type of industry or that type of industry, right? I mean, part of the problem
right. That
that Google has with maintaining the its own terms of service is that they don't want to deploy the number of people that is necessary to actually look at this stuff and get it right. So you get rid of, you demonetize Steven Crowder, but you're also demonetizing somebody who does, historical analysis of speeches of Hitler, as opposed to putting Hitler on there and praising him, and how these things are mediated makes a difference. I mean, context makes
a difference. I mean, I think with First Amendment being what it is, that really, going into this and putting it on a YouTube, a private government to regulate its own speech, I think is problematic. But what I would say is that in my view, the way to really deal with all this is you ban targeted ads. And what that would do, and I think there is a clear path to be able to do that, and I don't think it does actually call up First Amendment problems, is you just say that you can't track and surveil somebody around the web and then serve them very specific and particular, quote unquote, relevant advertising at every step of the way. And what that would do is that YouTube wouldn't not have an ad business under that form. It still has a big audience. It still could do research on that audience and know generally what that audience is, and then tell advertisers, well, we have a lot of people who, are in this age range or who have these certain interests. But then everybody would get to do that. And so the Wall Street Journal, which has a very high concentration of, decision makers and businesses, could go to their advertisers and say, this is what our market is, rather than now where Google and Facebook steal this market share by being able to geo-target those individuals very specifically, giving no reason for you to build up an audience of any kind of specialness, and be able to serve that the ads within that community. So if you have that...
All right, let me just see if I can restate that to you so that to make sure that I understand what you're saying, that there is an unfair advantage that a Facebook and a Google has in the advertising market that basically makes it impossible for anybody, you know, content creators for, you know, let's use a rather vulgar term for people, you know, doing journalism or whatever it is. For content creators to compete with these outlets so that I can't go to an advertiser and say, hey, I have whatever. I mean, if I was to do a survey and say, okay, I have people from 25 to 55 who, make anywhere from $35,000 to $100,000 a year, and they're interested in, that's the depth of the data that I can get. They're interested in rock climbing. But YouTube, or I should say Google and Facebook, can go like, oh, we can not only tell you, we can tell you the zip code they live in, we can tell you the magazines they buy, what their search terms are.
Right. And if you want a universe of 50,000 people who like rock climbing, we can give you those 50,000 people who we know like rock climbing because we read their email.
With a one-to-one yield, as opposed to what Sam Cedar can do or the Washington Post can do or anybody else can do.
Or Rock Climbing Magazine. Right. So, you know, it has ruined sort of the uniqueness of these particular universes, these demographic markets within... content creators, to use your word. And so if you eliminated that, if you just said, look, for privacy reasons, we're not going to let you surveil us anymore, then everybody's on a more level playing field. And this whole, you know, demonetization thing might become less of an issue if you can build up an audience and say, hey, I have an audience that is pretty good for advertisers, and advertisers might want to come in. Because the monetization is around ads, right? I mean, that's what it is. It's you have an audience such that you can acquire ads on YouTube. Well, if you can sort of acquire ads on your own through your own separate service that isn't connected to Google, and you can make it survive because Google isn't essentially stealing the uniqueness of your market.
Right.
Well, then you have a different ecosystem. You have a different environment and one that I think is better for individuals.
It's a fascinating dynamic and a conversation. I think it's one we're going to hear more of, right? I mean, do you have that sense? Like, let me ask you this then, just as a final question. There was an announcement this week that Cicilline from Rhode Island is going to start hearings on this in the House. But there was also an announcement this week that the DOJ and the FTC had basically resolved who was going to be looking into this in terms of Google and Facebook and other big tech companies. How for reals do you think that is?
It's hard to know. I mean, I think that the investigation from the congressional side is real.
Right.
We know that Lina Khan, who has risen to some manner of prominence, who wrote this great law review paper about Amazon and antitrust, now works in Cicilline's office, and is going to be very involved with this investigation. Which my view is it should be more wide ranging than tech firms. I think that if we broke up Google, Facebook, and Amazon today, we'd still have a terrible concentration problem in America. And maybe it will go in that direction. But I think there's a tremendous opportunity there to do something like a PCORA commission for economic concentration, or a temporary national economic committee, which was this thing in FDR era that actually looked at economic concentration and really fomented a lot of really good law and moves by the antitrust authorities. As for the FTC and the Justice Department, it seems like they worked out some jurisdictional issues. We have this weird situation in America where we have two agencies that do antitrust enforcement, and there are no clear lines between who does what. It's just sort of thrown into one bucket after another, and there isn't this great coordination around it. And so the fact that they actually said, okay, you take this and we'll take that, it signals that, you know, they wouldn't do that if they weren't planning to do something, right? But what that's going to be, I mean, honestly, after seeing this group in place at the FTC and the Justice Department in the Trump era, you're just going to have to show me before I'm convinced that you're interested in rooting out anti-competitive behavior and really getting something done.
But, in the event that there is a Democratic administration that is amenable to this, you know, to changing the sort of the Chicago School Robert Bork regime of antitrust and return to one that is sort of broader in its perspective. It's nice to have this started there, I guess, right?
And I think that's why the Cicilline Committee is important, because that role is going to be to raise awareness, to identify these issues within the economy, to talk about the implications, to lay out a fact pattern of the role of, in this case, these tech companies, these digital platforms, in our everyday lives, and to do that in a high profile way. And that's going to, you know, simply have resonance with the next Democratic administration, particularly if it comes in 2020 and after 2020 election. That's why I think that is that will be an enduring set of facts about the state of the economy today that can then be used by the enforcement agencies. And we've seen that done before. We've seen it in the context, particularly of banks. I'm thinking about Carl Levin's great reports from the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations about Goldman Sachs and about HSBC. This was, you know, right after the crisis, and then informed not just some of the enforcement priorities, but it also informed the actual policymaking in Washington around Dodd-Frank. So, I am hopeful more for the committee's work and giving Congress a role again in economic policymaking. I'm not so optimistic about Trump's FTC and Trump's antitrust division of the Justice Department, but we'll see.
David Dayan, always a pleasure. Folks should head over right now to, what is it? What is the URL?
Prospect.org.
Prospect.org. Sign up, subscribe to the Prospect, support David Dayan's work and the team that he's assembling over there. David, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And we'll have a lot more to say on the Prospect in coming weeks.
Great. All right, folks. David Dayan, ladies and gentlemen. An American treasure. How many years have I been saying that?
Certainly at least since I've been working with you, and I'm assuming well before that.
Yes.
Another thing, didn't even have time, but you'll have to have him on again really soon for this incredible piece he just did explaining the mechanics of how Tom Perez won the DNC race, even more dirty and disgusting than anybody expected.
Where did he write that?
American Prospect.
When did that come up this morning?
Literally just now. It must have been.
Son of a bitch. And did he write it while we were doing the interview?
Basically, Puerto Rican Republican politicians and Andrew Cuomo and a sellout on statehood is why. I mean, I guess in fairness, we do have the most charismatic DNC chair ever.
Wow. All right. Well, I will go check that out. Folks, head over there and check out David's work and check out the Prospect, and a very good way of spending your post-majority FM dollars. All right. Speaking of Post-Majority FM, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Andy Kindler will be here. We've got a lot to talk about with Kindler. We'll be right back after this. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, in many ways, our next guest needs no introduction. However, I will give him one as soon as we play this little ditty.
Do I need to vamp for you, Brendan?
With a Jew like as soon as we play this,
you know, this little ditty.
Here we go.
His ancestors wrote the God Bless America song. A true Obama bot, and he believes Obama can never be wrong. Yeah, AndyKindler.com. You made me laugh so hard, I had to write you your own theme song. Andy Kindler.
AndyKindler.com. I'm going to head there right now. Oh, it's up.
Oh, my God. And the world's greatest picture of me.
I wish I still had
that sweater vest.
Michael had told me that you're...
this morning it was down. Is the website back up?
Yeah, the website is back up. And I know it's back up because I'm in the room where someone says, and I like this part of it, Kindler, on the other hand, ranks among the worst IMO.
What?
That's in the chat room.
You're in a
I
chat?
I rank as one of the worst, says Salvatore Ippolito. But only IMO, in his opinion.
Wait, you have a chat room? Is that right?
No, your chat room.
No,
your
he's
chat.
Sitting. Andy does a disastrous practice, which is he literally, while he's supposed to be in the moment with us, basically making fun of Dennis Miller, essentially, or making Jew jokes, he insists on watching the YouTube chat, which is not
great.
No,
but I wanted to see what you look like. I can't see Michael, but I can see you, Sam. Am I the oldest Jew? I see Sam. I see a picture of myself.
There you go.
It is funny when people add the, like, in my honest opinion. It's like, really?
Yeah, exactly.
Was there anything that you were behind, like, the Grand Baron of Semen, like, screen username where you're anonymously making dumb comments all day? It's not in your honest opinion? Okay.
Let me be frank.
Let me be perfectly blunt here as the bong rip master. In my honest opinion.
I owe it to my moniker, a thousand spiders crawling all over me, that I am completely honest with my opinion of Andy Kindler. Well, I'm glad to see your website is back up, Andy, because it was down today. And
whose website?
Yours, AndyKindler.com.
Are you
That's
kidding
what
me?
Said.
It was when I clicked on it this morning. Up. It was not opening, Andy.
Oh my God!
Your link from Twitter.
I tell everybody, if you like a website where nothing ever changes, where everybody knows your name, where the dates from 2005 are still featured, you can't do better than AndyKindler.com.
Now wait a second. What is this whole Big Phony Studios in association with Straight to DVD Enterprises presents I Wish I Was Bitter? Is that new? I never noticed that on your site before.
If you think 2006 is new.
All right.
No, it's not new, but it's funny. And I'm going to have another album coming out. It's called Hence the Humor that I've been sitting on for 3 years because I can't get anything done. And you know what I talked about yesterday in therapy? I talked about the fact that I cry often because I wanted Obama to be perfect, and I realize he's not perfect, so I cry about it. Maybe I am an Obama bot.
Wow. When did you come to this realization about Obama?
Yesterday. Oh, no, well, what I'm doing, I mean, not to get serious, but most people think this segment of the show is serious, is I have been struggling with the fact that I grew up in a family where everybody had to be perfect. Everybody had to be perfect, and if everybody wasn't perfect, that meant they were terrible. So when I used to go on, online, people would go, Obama's a war criminal, Obama's a war. I couldn't take it. But now I'm realize that I do love Obama. He wasn't perfect. He wasn't a war criminal, but he wasn't perfect. And who is perfect?
You know, Andy, I mean, I hate to play the Sam role here, but if we're being really technical on a legal level, he was a war criminal.
Oh, no. You see, this is a thing. No, I have to be able to hear this. You're saying he is a war criminal. I appreciate your take on it.
Hey, any president of the United States. Any president of the United States, a war criminal by definition, Andy. It's okay.
No, it's not.
If it's matzo ball soup, the matzo balls, and oh, stop. You know that I didn't mean it was actually okay. I'm helping Andy here.
Wait a second. Let's hold on. Let's take one thing at a time here. We're burying the lead. Because we all know that
war crimes are burying the lead now. Sell out Cedar.
We all know that that Obama's a war criminal. We're burying the lead because the lead is Andy's. Needed everything black and white. Is that basically what I'm hearing?
That's exactly true.
Everything
that
had to be
exactly
binary.
True. So when I would argue with people, and especially with my family, when it was an argument to the death, if they could point out something about the person that I didn't like, this wasn't just about Obama. This is about do you realize in 1968, Andy Kindler supported Hubert Humphrey for president, a 12-year-old Andy Kindler.
Well, so wait a second. So I mean,
wait, you supported Humphrey over Kennedy and McCarthy as
Kennedy
a 12-year-old?
Kennedy, I don't know if you heard, Kennedy was dead.
Well, no, but there was a lot of Kennedy. People that supported RFK before he was assassinated, Andy.
No, I was against the people supporting McCarthy, like my parents. Not against them, but I thought Hubert Humphrey was a reasonable guy. And how about Vietnamization of the war? I didn't believe that. But.
All right. So wait a second. We need to get back to it. Now we're getting confusing by bringing in more presidents and presidential candidates.
Yeah.
But just in terms of a dynamic, everything is black and white. You're either good. I mean, because I think to a certain extent, this is also a problem that we have broadly in society, right? Like nuanced things are a little bit different. I had a very similar problem as far as if someone is upset with me, I don't know how to deal with that.
I have that in spades and hearts.
Right. So you either you don't know how to just sort of sit like, oh, that person's upset. Okay, I'll give them time to get over it. It either has to be a full on fight or nothing.
Right. And that comes from the way I was taught. I was just raised that way. There was no difference in my family. And I love my family. And I hope they're not listening. But there was no difference between your behavior and who you were as a person. Your behavior defined. If you were acting badly, you were a bad person. They didn't mean to do it, but it hurt.
Okay, so you came to the conclusion that Obama is not the best, and
no, that's not. But here's the thing: I still love Obama, so I still love Obama. I think anybody who's going to be president tomorrow has to make decisions, and those decisions are going to be either you hate those decisions, but they're going to make a decision, and they have to make a decision about drones and all this kind of stuff. So.
Shut the fuck up, Andy.
My thing was Syria. I thought maybe we should have gone in on Syria or something like that. So when I'm so defensive, if he has to be perfect for me to like him at all, then I have to make the argument that he's perfect. And that's just not possible with anybody.
I see. So that's why you were such an Obama bot, is because you had to be.
Because I would take the bait online. I would take the Cornel West bait, which, forget about the technical discussion about whether you think he's a war criminal, but that was the bait, Oh, Obama. Or it's like, the other part of it is like, I believe in free trade, but I don't know anything about free trade, really. So
you sound like Thomas Friedman.
Free trade, because then people think I'm a right wing person. But I believe in the concept of free trade. But I'm so scared to say any of my opinions, because if people then think I'm conservative, whatever the thing is, it just gets like you can't have a you can't live really.
Someone get this man.
If you have that way,
Times
if you're thinking column. That way all the time.
Well, all right. So, Andy, you've come out now as a hardcore conservative. And,
no Supreme Court, no money for poor people in general.
Hey, Andy, Andy, would you say that you left the party or the party left you? And...
I can't get enough of that. You know what? I spoke to David Gergen last night, and normally I hate his guts, but he brought up some interesting points.
I was at a landmark forum retreat with David Gergen, and we were not allowed to use the bathroom for 12 hours. And by the end of it, I agreed we should phase out Social Security.
Is triangulation such a dirty word?
Oh, my God.
Why, Sam, if I disappointed you somehow, I always am worried. That's another thing, too, from therapy. I'm worried that Sam Cedar either doesn't get me, he doesn't think I'm one of the world's greatest reference comedians.
That's not true. I do.
No. But there's nothing. There's nothing you could do that would make me feel good about myself if I'm in the mode of, if Sam has to love me, everybody has to love me, I have to let it go at age 40.
Well, but you know, you don't have to let that go, because you can always assure yourself that I do love you.
No, I am getting much better. But here's the thing.
And that I'm the only important person. I'm the only important person when it comes to your calculation as to whether you're loved.
Absolutely. Because of our multi-year deal. I never knew that making an exclusive deal to appear on a show like this would not involve money. That's the thing. I can't believe a 5-year deal. I can't go anywhere else. I can't go on the Rubin Report.
Well, I noticed that you were on Dave Feldman's show the other day. I mean, that was why you were ignoring all my texts.
Is he too right wing?
Yeah, Feldman is. It's just yeah.
Oh, I would say at this point, no. Feldman's getting good. Feldman's pulling. You know, Andy, I got to tell you, not only. In addition to insulting Cornel West, one of our most prominent, important intellectuals and leaders in the country, and coming out as a virulent reactionary, the fact that David Feldman could basically be your brother, and he is moving further to the left every day, does not bode well for the next time you're bothering Chris Cuomo, my friend.
Oh, my God, Chris Cuomo. Oh, my God, Chris Cuomo. Here's Chris Cuomo. Look, people.
Success.
You don't get it. I get it. So let's get after it. He is our teacher now, Chris Cuomo, our teacher. let's get after it. Let's get after it.
When you go into therapy, does your therapist say, like, Andy, I feel like, did you go on Sam's show this week? So I feel like some of our work has been,
Sam's show.
I feel like some of our work has been undone.
No. But when I tell her about things that I do on Twitter, she told me that 6 months ago after when I had a war with someone named like Razorblade and Apple or Loves the Serial Kill, whatever these people are, robots. She said, what do you get out of it, Andy? What do you get out of it?
I hope you told her everything.
What's that?
I hope you told her everything.
Well, no, I mean, about getting into feuds or like the worst. Did you know that 3 weeks ago I actually made an error that I was almost crying? I thought the Federalist Society and the Federalist website or whatever the hell it is were the same people. For like 3 hours, I was one of those people on the internet who thought they were right about something wrong.
Oh, I think I saw that, and people really got off, went after you, and you really got defensive about it.
No, but I did. No, eventually I apologized because I was so wrong. I had looked up, I Googled something. Hey, who owns it? Do these two people own by the same? If you Google, are these two people owned by the same people? You'll get an answer that goes, you bet they are.
Hey, yes. Google, is Barack Obama a war criminal? I'm seeing yes, 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 yes. Oh, there's a no. Thank you, Google.
Thank you, Google.
Thank you, very. Hey, did Barack Obama kill anybody in Yemen?
Am I right to love Barack Obama? Thank you, Google.
Thank you, Google. Google understands me.
I looked up on Google. I said, am I right? All I said was, am I right? They said, yes.
You're and right. That's what's so nice about Google. I'm right that Barack Obama is not a war criminal, and Bob is right that the Jews control the banks. We're all right. Thank
you,
Google machine.
If you
want
to find a different answer, go to Yahoo.
So now, oh, really? Is that, we got some, oh, boy. Oh, it's old. Oh, okay. Yeah, we got a video of Chris Cuomo driving a car before crashing it in a drag race.
Is that for drill? That's like Piers Morgan getting hit by like a cricket
Andy,
guy.
I'm looking at your calendar and it's updated. I think if it's, I mean, it just could be a coincidence because it's has a June date and a July date, and maybe it's just from a different year. But it appears...
No, it's my friend. You know, and by the way, I call them, when I go on tour in June and July, I spell it J-E-W-N-E and J-E-W-L-Y.
Of course. But you're both in Canada. Are you not allowed to perform in the States anymore?
No, I just can't get any bookings in the States.
Oh,
I'm allowed to. Sure. No one will book me.
Oh,
no.
So in other words, you're being censored. In other
I'm
words, you're being censored.
National.
If you're not allowed to make money at a comedy club, you're being censored. Is that right? Is that
exactly.
What I understand?
Remember when Kathy Griffin used to say, I've been banned from David Letterman. No, you haven't. He just doesn't book you. That's what it is.
I was banned from Letterman. I was banned the entire time that he was on.
No, you weren't.
I was.
Because you weren't booked, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you call that?
I was blacklisted. Because I didn't do comedy.
Oh.
Andy, now
yeah,
do we
talk
have
to
any,
me.
What's happening with Ben Shapiro? I mean, Ben Shapiro. Do we have Dennis Miller? Do we have any Dennis Miller?
I just started looking. I started looking recently because I didn't know I was going to be on the show until I realized that I forgot to give you my number.
Yeah. Do we have any Dennis Miller? Is there any, Brendan? No. Couldn't find any, right?
No.
Oh,
I'm
darn.
Sorry, but I looked this morning, Michael. I looked at just conservative comics. You know, like there's a conservative comedy tour, but they don't have any dates right now.
Why is that? Do you know why they don't?
If you go to their website, it's pretty hilarious. It's
pop this up.
You go to their website and they go, new dates coming soon.
Who are the conservative comics?
Oh, it's called The Deplorables, a comedy show tour for conservative thinkers, Trump supporters, and good old American deplorables. You get the joke there? They're taking what you call them, and they're saying, yeah, we own it. We're racists.
It's reappropriating. we're taking the racism, and we're owning it. That's impressive.
Yeah. Come over to our house. We're the racists. Yes. Yes, it's true.
I can't argue with Nick DiPaolo's new set, though.
What's that?
You can't argue with Nick DiPaolo's new set. That's pretty good stuff.
Well, I like Nick DiPaolo, so I can't even talk about Nick DiPaolo because I know that there's problems. But he's an old friend, and so what's happened? Is it bad? Because
that's human.
There it is.
No. It was really funny.
Anyone who doesn't find it funny is probably just an uptight SJW.
Andy, it was really, really funny.
Oh, we got it.
No, you're joking with me. You're trying
No. I mean, I felt like I was somewhere in 1989. It was fresh.
But remember, I did the Young Comedian special with Nick DiPaolo, and he was a very funny comic.
No, you know what?
You know, he's been a friend of mine, but I don't know anything about the recent stuff, and that's the new Andy. Oh, I haven't heard about these negative things.
You know what Nick DiPaolo said, though? And as he said, I'll tell you this, you know, like white guys get no respect anymore, which is why Barack Obama was president. But in the spirit of bipartisanship, he's not a war criminal. That's fucking bullshit. So he did say that.
I can't believe it. He went in the back door on me.
Oh, we got 12 minutes of him with Bill O'Reilly. Apparently, Miller did an hour with Ben Shapiro and then reconnected with Bill O'Reilly. We could watch a little bit of that.
Oh, I definitely want to watch this reunion.
Jamie's going to...
taking years off my life, guys.
I know, but this is
Jan, I'm sorry.
This is the reunion,
this,
right?
There's no reason you should have to go through this.
This is the reunion.
It looks festive.
Do you guys have an older group, older YouTube group I can talk to?
Let's
from the old days.
Let's watch this. Okay. Oh, Dennis Miller's New Deal? Is that what they're calling it? Oh, I see. Okay. All right, good.
It's Miller. And I sent out a fleet to find him, and I have. I found him. But first, before he comes in, I got to do all this stuff. Ready? So Miller has a podcast on Westwood One, and it's called the Dennis Miller Option. I guess you could opt out with giving, you see, All right, so now it's a no-holds-barred, uncensored take on current events, politics, pop culture, anything else is on Miller's mind. Joining him on his no-holds-barred uncensored podcast is A-list guests from across every spectrum, along with his guy Friday, Christian Black.
You know what I like about this?
It
really does feel like these guys are old buddies. Like they somehow buried the hatchet, and now, you know, and O'Reilly's giving them some good-natured ribbing.
You know what I feel uncomfortable with a little bit, and I actually like most of this so far. It is very good-natured. There's a little part of Miller that is like, this is all really fun, but it's like, if you stay just this drunk, we'll have a good segment. But if you get more drunk, I'm scared.
Right. Sounds like he's doing this in his basement. But go ahead.
He's so warm.
Anyway, you can find Miller on Apple Podcasts, so Google, Westwood One Podcast, every podcast. If you want to see him live, he's going to be in Connecticut at Foxwoods on April 26th. Then the next day up in Medford, Massachusetts, outside of Boston on the 27th. And then in Austin, Texas on May 1st. So here he is, live from Santa Barbara, California, the podcast king, Dennis Miller. So you got a guy Friday. I guess you've always wanted that Robinson Crusoe, correct?
Well, for years I played
Robinson
guy Friday,
Crusoe.
You've gone into a more avuncular, quasi-retired state where you're wearing Dinty Moore lumberjack shirts.
I know,
but I remember a day when you had that perfectly knotted Windsor, and we stood astride the cable news world like a latter-day Colossus of Rhodes.
And nobody will ever match it, by the way. But I never referred to you as my guy Friday. I mean, you were equal footing with me. I mean, I gotta have a talk with this Christian Blatt guy. Okay, now I asked him. You know, the Green New Deal is sweeping the country. I'm sure
they
it's big in Santa
ban.
Barbara, California.
They put the
but
ban
I want the
in
Miller
banter.
New Deal, exactly. Not the Green New Deal. I want Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to hear the Miller New Deal. Go.
Well, first off, Bill, I would say they're obviously laying claim to FDR's lineage, right? And I was thinking, if FDR was alive today, after he'd put 120,000 Sino-Americans or Japanese-Americans, into internment camps, plus you mix in the fact that they would call him a hack industrialist today, it's so funny to me that FDR would be considered at this point by people like AOC and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris to be some sort of hack moderate industrialist. The villagers in Frankenstein.
I'm trying to think of like why you would see say AOC, Kamala Harris, and Cory Booker.
That's a very because I really right. That was right because on the merits, like FDR, if we updated FDR to 2019, he would obviously be to the left of Harris and Booker. What is the shared trait that those AOC. Three have in this
weird.
Rundown?
Maybe we should pull up a picture of them all.
That is just a strange, like, of all the candidates that you would mention at this point in the race, it's just weird. It's just weird.
I like history-based, historical. It's like Dennis Miller gets to be like, eh, by the standards of the 40s, I'm pretty progressive, Billy.
Let's go.
Hey, Chris Matthews called a couple of weeks ago, called Kamala Harris the hard left. It's the hard left.
Yeah, super hard.
Super hard.
It would be after him with Thornton, too. So that's funny to me that they would use classic FDR terminology. Listen, I would only list one extra coda in the New Green Deal, and that would be that I would have to use some sort of meat thermometer to catch a little heat coming off Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's head off her brain before I took anything she said seriously. Because right now, I think that is a flatline electroencephalograph. I think she parrots exactly what she thinks young people want to hear. I don't think she makes any sense. And listen, the way they do it, Bill, it's so funny to me. They use fancy jargon. But, you know, in some point, they are advocating that we go into the agricultural community and moderate some of the CO2 discharges there. And then also that we, at some point, do away with air travel and retrofit all buildings. Now, if I go back in and say, do you realize what it would cost to retrofit every green building in every building to make it green in America? If we did away with air travel, if we had a kid function as a fart caddy to walk around behind cows and catch it, how crazy that is. As soon as you say it, they say, well, we didn't say it quite that way. That's in essence what they're saying, and it's absolutely insane.
But they don't care, Miller. You see, in the Miller New Deal, I would expect a responsible analysis of the world's predicament. And then if you did give me some crazy thing, I'd call you on it. I'd say, Miller, you're out of your mind. You're this. But the press is so enamored with this Green New Deal. But I'm going to make a prediction right on the No Spin News tonight, Miller. In 4 years, perhaps two, Ms. Cortez will not be in Congress. You know where she's going to be?
Running for the White House?
Co-hosting The View. I can almost guarantee it.
Oh, God.
Co-hosting
these
The
guys,
View. How long can Behar last? Behar has got to go.
These guys I don't even know if I can be funny this is if not, you tickled them.
It's not, I mean, it's not as fun anymore when they're both basically in their basement.
Where are the Star Trek analogies?
Do they sound that way, or is it they both? Do they both sound horrible on their actual show, like they're coming from a bunker?
Doesn't it sound that way to you? Like they haven't done any sound deadening in there? I mean, I don't know what the I may have to pass on the Dennis Miller New Deal. I don't know if it's going to be if we're actually going to get it, but it is sort of fascinating how these guys just completely focus on a very narrow band of what constitutes Democrats.
I have a very, 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 very elaborate, weird, and frankly confusing way of just calling somebody stupid, Billo.
He also said he accused somebody of having fancy jargon. Isn't that his entire act? Indubitably. He's three years from saying indubitably.
I definitely want to. We're going to have to dig through the Ben Shapiro, Dennis Miller stuff to really dig.
Just to compare the speeds.
Stuff. Yeah.
I'm on the hunt for a funny right wing comedian. I'm ready to see.
Stephen Crowder.
Not just P.J. O'Rourke.
Stephen Crowder.
Wait, P.J. O'Rourke?
See, now that's where I know I'm out of the loop. I don't know who Stephen Crowder is, and I feel bad about it.
He's like Nick DiPaolo. This is another guy, regardless of you think of his politics, undeniably funny. I can't even do
that.
I can't even do a. He made a
one big time.
I can't even do. He made an Obama isn't a war criminal observation because he's too room temperature for that. By the way, Dennis Miller, you could just say somebody's room temperature and that works instead of like a heat off of their brain. Flatline.
Oh,
I thought when
God.
He said heat.
What the hell is he ever talking about?
I thought when he said that, he was going to connect that with global warming. Like, I got to tell you one thing that isn't contributing to CO2 emissions. Bop, bop, bop. But instead, it just trailed
convection,
off.
With a convection oven. Choo, choo, choo.
I got to come up with a way of saying that she's stupid, but I'm too. I just don't have the energy.
So, she got an encephalogram. She's got a right wing encephalogram. He is so angry. That's the thing. Was this 3 months ago that he said he's going away from the politics?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
He's more angry now than ever.
I Googled him to see, and it was the exact same, like, title. Like, you know, a comedian decides to wade into conservative politics. He's been doing this for 20 years.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Now he's saying, you know what? I'm doubling down. We're doubling down on my insightful, hilarious political humor.
I was going to stop talking about politics, but then I realized there was a lot of women who are getting acclaim in the Democratic Party. So I had to continue on it. People who are not necessarily white. So
I can no longer be happy with anybody who I respect who's still friends with him. I'm going to have to call anybody I know and tell them, cut him off.
Is that what you're doing?
Not really, because it's like people like, you know, like the people who were friends like Dana Carvey, they tried to avoid. I'm sure there's nobody who's actually friends with him. He's such a horrible human being, inside and out.
Now, how often do you talk to Nick DiPaolo?
I haven't talked to him in a long time, in many, many years. And in fact, I'm literally doing that thing where I'm not going I guess I should watch what they're talking. Is it real? Give me a 1 to 10 scale.
Well, the cover of his album is him giving the finger to a bunch of Black Lives Matters people. And
wait, that's Andy's next cover.
And
I can't even
believe it. Hey, Andy.
That's funny. No.
Andy, is that your next cover? Fuck you, Black Lives Matter.
Try and check and make sure none of them are dead, though.
Right. Well, that his first cover, he was giving the finger to one of the activists who was shot, I think, by the cops. And
I would say not a good choice, I would say.
So he apologized and he said, I just found the images online, and he re-photoshopped it to it's now all women of color. I think that he's just giving the finger to. But then his material.
He's doing a character. You don't get it. He's doing a character.
Yeah, you know what was great about Nick is that he would maintain character even off air.
That's true. It's true.
He was so dedicated.
I'd say, come on, you're killing me, Nick. Get off of the character.
Yeah, he would just do his character. I told this story when we talked about it, when we I cast him in Beat Cops back in like 20 years ago. And
right.
He had said, maybe it was even more, and He was moving back to New York from L.A., he said to me. And I said, why is that? And he's like, oh, because, you know, they won't give any parts to white guys out there.
This is the greatest thing I've ever
seen. Did Nick DiPaolo, hide you in a bathroom or something when you were doing, like, a comedy sketch, a comedy set somewhere, and some, like, Klansmen attacked the stage? Is that what happened?
What's that? I missed that.
Did DiPaolo, were you and Nick DiPaolo ever in a situation where he hid you while some of his potential brethren were out to get you at a comedy club as an example?
Well, I why do I sound like I'm on trial?
Yeah, you don't sound bad in this example, Andy. I'm just curious.
Let's hear it, Andy.
Give it to me again, because I didn't hear it completely.
I heard a story recently that Feldman couldn't do a show. I forget where it was, but there was literally, like, enough local Nazi activity, whenever this was, that the local promoter was like, no, you're not. It's not safe for you, not safe for the club. And so I'm wondering if were you and Nick DiPaolo ever in a situation, maybe at a comedy club together, both doing sets, and a certain part of the audience maybe was not as charmed by your heritage and your abundant expression of your heritage. And Nick DiPaolo told his buddies to stand down. And that's one of the reasons you're so fond of him.
Let the Jew. He said the Jew's okay. Let the Jew.
That's what I'm saying. Because I feel like Nick DiPaolo seems like actually a very nice guy in that way. So I could totally see
Andy's know good. Him. Like, I know him from back in the day, but I never was in the same. I'm now denying any. No, I used to think he was. I mean, he was funny, but I don't know what I'm saying.
Oh, Andy's ready to throw him under the bus based off of the description of a record cover.
I just cursed.
Let's just shit
on
Feldman.
Are you about to curse? No.
All right. Well, listen, Andy. So
that's it. No,
what?
I'm sorry.
It's where. So
I die. I like when I do a mediocre set and I go, that's it. That's all the time we have.
The food wasn't very good and the portions were small.
That's still the greatest joke. There's no better joke than that joke.
Andy.
The food is so... Hey, Sam, you never ask me how I am.
So, how are you, Andy?
Don't ask!
Well, remember the Calgary, bunch of middle-aged Canada, Jewish ladies are out for lunch? Remember that one, Andy?
Yeah, and the waiter comes up to the table, and what does he say, Michael?
Is anything all right?
Jeez.
Unreal.
That's so good.
Hey, the Jewish kid goes up to his father. He goes, Dad, can I borrow $50? And the father goes, $40? How can I give you $30? If I had $25, you think I'd give you $15? You won't get $10 or I'm not giving you a dollar.
I got to do that with Myla. She's constantly asking me for money. I got to do that for Myla.
$40? I don't have $30. You think if I had $25, I would give it? If I had $18 high, you're not
Andy,
getting it.
Oh, we got Andy, demonetized.
What's that?
We got demonetized.
Andy, thanks for demonetizing us. Andy, so if people want to catch you, they just need to go to Calgary, Canada. Is that right?
I'm going to be. And don't forget to listen to my podcast.
Oh, right.
Which
Thought
everybody's
Spiral.
Talking
of course.
About.
It's of course.
Called Thought Spiral with of me course. And. And if you like one Jew, you'll like two Jews.
There you go. It gets a super spiralery.
Yeah, I love you so much.
Andy,
and thank you for letting me bare my soul today.
Yeah, no, I was very excited to hear that. I'm glad you opened up with this, Andy. I'm glad it didn't get too much. We got to save some for next time.
Sounds terrible what you just said. Right. I'm glad you weren't too real.
I'm glad you didn't get too sincere with us, Andy. And always a pleasure. Love you, buddy.
I love you guys. All Have right. a great weekend.
Bye-bye. Love you.
Bye.
Andy Kindler, ladies and gentlemen. Andy Kindler. let's just play this Joe Rogan thing. It's pretty funny. And then we will go into the fun half. Apparently, David Pakman was on the Joe Rogan show sometime in the past couple of days. And they were talking about the demonetizing of Steven Crowder. And, you know, we'll have more to talk about this in the fun half because, you know, to me, just the idea that this is censorship is just absurd, particularly in Steven Crowder's case. You know, I mean, I suppose theoretically, if there are people who are only relying on you, when you demonetize somebody, suppose if you deplatform somebody, you could say that they're being censored in some fashion. But to demonetize, to me, doesn't seem that way at all. But here is Joe Rogan asking if harassing Carlos Maza has an equivalency on the left. And I will say this, that like the harassment of Carlos Maza, I think, has been overstated as a reason for YouTube's action. I think it's just the general gay bashing, which has been problematic. Michael yesterday read the terms of service of YouTube. And, you know, there are protected classes of people in our society. Their protections are only not as individuals, but as classes of people. So, you know, let's use this as a jumping off point. Here is David Pakman with Joe Rogan.
Is that different, in your opinion, than someone singling something out for what you believe is their mental incompetency?
Well, the mental incompetence, do you mean that they're ignorant or that they're mentally ill or cognitively limited?
Cognitively limited. Mocking their ability to think, well, mocking their intelligence, mocking their decisions, mocking the way they talk, and then encouraging other people to do the same thing. And then that person gets harassed based on their intelligence, based on their performance on particular YouTube videos and conversations. And there's active harassers. There's people that do that. Is there a difference between, say, what Sam Cedar does to Dave Rubin?
What does Sam do to Dave Rubin?
He has.
I don't know that I've seen that video.
Dozens of videos. Don't say that video. He has dozens of videos where he's just dunking on Dave Rubin.
So, I have some as well. I believe that they are substantive. That's my view, is that my videos about Dave Rubin are substantive. Mm-hmm. I don't really watch any left-wing stuff because I want to try to isolate myself enough to make sure that what I'm saying are my ideas and that I'm not taking them.
Set.
So I don't, Sam's a friend of mine.
Sounds like a comic.
And that's interesting. Yeah.
Comics do that.
I don't know, but if there are some specific examples, we could comment about them. But I think that there, to your first question, there is a difference between going after someone for sexual orientation,
right,
than going after them for the fact that they say things that are wrong or don't know stuff, until you're making fun of someone who has an actual handicap of some kind of, you know, cognitive limitation that would be a disability of some kind. Then you are mocking someone for a disability.
But the resulting effect of the harassment... See, this is what I was getting at before with Crowder. Like, what Crowder said was one thing, but one of the things that Carlos Mesa was discussing was what the people that had watched Crowder, what they were doing, how they were going after.
All right. Well, I mean, you know.
Raises some serious questions about our ethical responsibilities if Dave Rubin is indeed a touched individual.
Well, yeah, and I don't think that Dave Rubin is, you know, has any type of particular limitations beyond what appears to be a lack of research or reasoning or thoughtfulness about what he does.
Now, sounds like a limitation.
Let me just address a couple of things. One, it's true. We do have dozens of videos dunking on Dave Rubin, but it is not because Dave Rubin is anything other than a commentator who is saying stuff that is nonsensical. I don't criticize Dave Rubin for anything other than either misrepresenting the truth, being completely unknowledgeable, but fairly, but very confident about putting out opinions about stuff, misrepresenting his positions, and for laundering people who have really horrible, detrimental effects on society. The idea that Dave Rubin is harassed online, I'm not worried about Maza being harassed online. People get harassed online all the time. I'm not even, like, worried about the doxing insofar as it relates to Steven Crowder, because Steven Crowder, to my, at least as far as I know, has not called for him to be doxed. I think that would be irresponsible. The problem with what Crowder has done is by, and I think, you know, basically I said this the other day before Rogan had made this point. When you are attacking someone based on the fact that they're gay, or that they're of a certain ethnicity or a color or religion, whatever it is,
disability.
Gender, disability, you are poisoning society in a way that has implications for hundreds of thousands, sometimes in millions of people. You are impacting the structure of society by criticizing and dunking on Dave Rubin because he keeps saying things that are not bright on YouTube or are demonstrably wrong or are demonstrably misinformed or are demonstrable misrepresentations does not have the societal implications. Well, I don't care if people call me names. And,
well, and also I just want to really underline it too, that even if Crowder did a bunch of videos saying, I think Carlos Mesa's dumb and I'm going to refute his points and make fun of him and do an offensive impression, that is still, first of all, that would not be an issue. And it is
perfectly
not what he's
legitimate.
Doing that got him on the radar.
Well,
yeah,
according
not.
To Joe Rogan,
not.
We are being ableist towards Dave Rubin.
Well, that's the thing I do want to say is I think Joe is opening up, especially for those of us in the studio who are more worried about these things, a very concerning point, which I have thought of from time to time myself, which is that if Dave has a real limitation, I'd like him to publicly say that. I will certainly change up at least my programming.
But we're not. I don't. I mean, well, okay. I mean, if you're saying that he has some type of disability, but I don't think that. I mean, maybe he does.
That's what I'm saying. Is I don't know. That was never articulated in that way in terms of Dave before. And I mean, shit. I don't want to. That would put a whole different paint job on it for me.
I believe the phrase Joe Rogan used was cognitively limited.
if Dave Rubin is cognitively limited, then I will do a slightly different impression.
But I'm not even, I don't, maybe we have, I mean, maybe we have, you know, in passing said that he's cognitively limited, you know, in reference to explain what he said. And maybe that is going a little too far. We could just simply say that he's just horribly, horribly ignorant to the issues, which I think is actually in many respects, and I've made this clear, I think, even more reprehensible. Because you have a responsibility, in my mind, if you're going to go on with, you know, whatever he has, a million followers on YouTube, you've got to do your homework, and you have a responsibility. But that's the way I feel about that.
Yeah, and to be clear, the issue is the specific incitement around the specific category. Not mocking somebody, not making fun of them, not debunking them, not being mean, not being satiric, not having people tweet at them or whatever. It's the specific use. And again, even according, in an incredibly strict sense, and I know we'll talk about it more later, but huge miscalculation by YouTube. They had a case, which is all Carlos Massa asked for, on one person who in fact violated their own written terms of service, which you agree to these stupid things when you set up a channel. That's it. There's actually should be really nothing more to it as of this case.
Right. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, folks, the event that we get deplatformed or we get demonetized for mocking certain people's cognitive limitations.
Hey, YouTube, 30 videos on my cognitive limitations. Where's the strike? First, you steal my followers, and now there's no representation for cognitively limited races.
It's so funny, too, though, because like the whole idea is supposed to be like, it's just about victimhood on the left.
Right.
Anyways. You can support this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, becoming a member. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Friday, which means that yesterday was Thursday, which means that the day prior to that was Wednesday. And then if you go a couple hours before it turns Wednesday, it is Tuesday night. What happened then, Michael?
Thomas Sankara, we discussed his legacy as the revolutionary leader of Burkina Faso. Fascinating conversation with Milton Alamadi that also included a history of the three waves of African liberation, how it relates to capitalism and neocolonization, and a bunch more content. You know, I can't possibly cover it all in the amount of time that we have. This Sunday for patrons, Rob Larson on capitalism versus freedom, negative and positive liberty, and why capitalism actually fails to deliver on both. And socialism could possibly deliver on both. Next Tuesday, Bhaskar Sunkara and Ben Burgess are both in studio. We're talking about the Finnish model and the future of a socialist project and our history. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have several collaborations for you guys. In our main episode, we speak with Grant and Lexi from Swampside Chats about the foundational 1974 communization text, The Eclipse and Reemergence of the Communist Movement, by Gilles Dauvé and Francois Martin. We like to call it the Moon Book. I'm still trying to wrap my head around some of this stuff, but I find it very interesting. We also have, for our patrons, the second ever edition of Prolet Cult, which is Andy's side project where he talks about UFOs, space news, the paranormal, the parapolitical, all sorts of good stuff. So on this episode, Sean and I are actually on it too. And we talk with Anna Merlin, who we spoke with last week, about her book Republic of Lies. And specifically in this one, we talk about the chapter on UFOs. So check it out. Also, we still have History as a Weapon, edition 2 of History. So many numbers. Don't worry about the numbers. The point is, Sean and Matt Chrisman know more about history and theory than anyone I've ever met. It's insane. The brains are totally broken by it. And they break down in really clear terms the ways in which the neoliberal turn of the 1970s, which continues to this day and is now breaking down, was overdetermined to a large degree by a crisis of capitalist accumulation that continues to this day. So check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt is not here with us today, and so folks should check out Literary Hangover for all of your literary hangover needs. Available on YouTube and as a podcast. Quick break. Head
Did
into
you get
the
that
fun
I
now.
Am? Sorry.
What was that? Oh, my God. Also, Michael's Chicago live show.
We got August 24th, link on the homepage.
Save some for the actual shows, guys.
Well, there's a lot more. I say get your tickets to the Chicago live show like 40 times.
All right. Quick break. Head into the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, back, back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt!
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds.